The headlines, reports coming out of Ukraine's capital say gunfire has erupted near the government district there on the second day of the military conflict with Russia. Ukraine's president says he is not afraid of talking about neutrality, as his request for joining NATO has remained unanswered. And France says it is speeding up the deployment of its troops in Romania a day after the U.S. announced the dispatch of thousands of forces to Germany. Welcome to the program. The conflict between Russia and Ukraine enters its second day. Moscow now says its forces have destroyed 118 Ukrainian military infrastructure sites. The Russian Defense Ministry has denied allegations it launched missile attacks on Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian government says Russia has bombed 33 civilian sites over the past day. Clashes have been reported just outside Kyiv. Inside the city, gunfire has been heard near the government district. Kyiv's municipal authorities have urged people to stay indoors as Russian forces approach the city. Since the early hours of Friday, blasts have been heard in other major Ukrainian cities as well. The president says the world has left his country alone.
This morning, we are alone in defending our country, just like yesterday. The most powerful forces in the world watch from afar. Have yesterday's sanctions persuaded Russia? We see in our skies and feel on the ground that they are not enough.
Zelensky has earlier said, or had earlier said, he's not afraid of taking or talking about neutrality, as his request for joining NATO has remained unanswered. The Ukrainian president says the Western military alliance is afraid of accepting his country. Over 100 Ukrainians have been killed since Russia began its attacks Thursday. Kyiv says it has killed dozens of Russian and pro-Russian troops. Moscow, meanwhile, says it controls Ukraine's skies. Sarah Flanders from the U.S.-based International Action Center says the country has instigated the ongoing conflict in Ukraine to achieve certain goals. She names those goals and explains why Washington is after them.
The real cost, the real cause is the relentless U.S.-NATO expansion right to the borders of Russia, and the using Ukrainian fascist forces to attack right to the borders of Russia with constant shelling, and the demand that that stop. Now, clearly, U.S. power is using Ukraine because what they want is to shut down any exchange and trade between Russia and the European Union. This is all about imposing sanctions at the harshest level, and U.S. corporate power needed a war to do this. And so they were bound and determined to do everything they could to instigate that war and to use every power, every missile, every armed force, including the Ukrainian fascist forces, in order to get that war.
The Russian foreign minister says his country is seeking to ensure demilitarization of the Ukrainian government and has no plan to occupy Ukraine. Sergei Lavrov says Russia wants the independence of the Ukrainian people. He added, Moscow doesn't see the possibility to recognize as democratic the current government in Kyiv. The top Russian diplomat also said his country is open to negotiations if Ukrainian forces lay down their arms. Western countries are strongly critical of the Russian military operation in Ukraine and imposed sanctions in response. Russia says it will remain part of the global economy despite those measures. Now, the British Defense Secretary is accusing Russia of planning to take the whole of Ukraine. Ben Wallace also says the Russian army has failed to deliver its main objective and lost more than 450 personnel so far. The British Defense Secretary says his country is pushing its allies to cut off Russia from the SWIFT global interbank payment system. French President Emmanuel Macron has also said his country will accelerate troop deployment to Romania to bolster NATO forces in Eastern Europe. That comes a day after another NATO member, the U.S., announced the dispatch of thousands of forces to Germany. The European Union, meanwhile, says it will impose, quote, the harshest package of sanctions on Russia.
We're now targeting 70% of the Russian banking market, but also key state-owned companies, including the field of defense. And these sanctions will increase Russia's borrowing costs, raise inflation, and gradually erode Russia's industrial base.
The top EU official was speaking after an emergency meeting with European leaders. The United States has also announced a wave of new sanctions on Moscow, targeting five major Russian banks. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has imposed sanctions against some 60 individuals and entities. Australia and the UK have taken similar measures as well. With the conflict raging between Russia and Ukraine, the West has been quick to levy sanctions and other penalties on Moscow, but eyebrows have been raised after Britain's political establishment publicly targeted Russia's flagship media outlet in the country. There are now concerns over whether the industry regulator will follow the existing media law or bow to political pressure. Amina Taylor is in London.
As the crisis escalates between Russia and Ukraine, it's the role of the media that's become increasingly crucial. In Britain's parliament, the leader of the opposition Labour Party waded into the discussion with a controversial position.
Russia today is his personal propaganda tool. I can see no reason why it should be allowed to continue to broadcast in this country. So will the Prime Minister now ask Ofcom to review its licence?
Mr. Speaker, I believe that my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, has already asked Ofcom to review that matter.
It's not the first time RT has been targeted, but long gone are the days of Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn appearing on the channel. Starmer is keen to stake his anti-Russian credentials.
Russia and the West are both acutely aware that the media battle is as important as any armed conflict. And by attempting to silence Russian media here in the United Kingdom, the British establishment is simply continuing a long-held tradition of censorship.
Political observers disagree with Starmer's stance.
It's totalitarian surveillance capitalism, essentially, which is continuing its ugly march through the West. I mean, where we actually prided ourselves in not being so censored, we're now at the stage where we're controlling media. At that point, of course, I know Press TV were victims of exactly this. There have been many people across social media who are constantly being censored. And I think it's a very dangerous development. And when it's normalized to the extent where, you know, the major party leaders, the prime minister, are all acting as if it's a perfectly normal thing to do. It's a very dangerous and dark day for democracy.
Though it's not publicly commented on whether there will be a probe, Ofcom's impartiality has already come under scrutiny, and observers are urging caution and for the organisation to abide by media rules, not political pressure.
It is always good to hear the other side of an argument anyway and an alternative narrative, so you can see and make a balanced judgment of what is going on. Because we know from the Iraq war and the propaganda about WMD that our own government doesn't necessarily tell the truth when it goes to broadcast either. These are very troubled times, and the last thing we need is censorship of our television viewing.
As calls ring out for calm heads and a de-escalation to prevail in the current crisis, media observers hope the people at home and abroad can have a plurality of media voices, this to help shape their views. Amina Taylor, London.
A jury in the U.S. state of Minnesota says three former police officers involved in the 2020 killing of black man George Floyd are found guilty of violating his civil rights.
Today, former officers Tao, King, and Lane stand convicted by a jury of their peers for willfully violating Mr. Floyd's civil rights, the same rights guaranteed to all of us by the United States Constitution. These officers had a moral responsibility, a legal obligation, and a duty to intervene. And by failing to do so, they committed a crime.
Based on U.S. legislation, all law enforcement officers must provide medical aid to those in their custody. Now, in Floyd's case, the three former cops are convicted of showing deliberate indifference to his medical needs. Two were also convicted of failing to stop the use of, quote, unreasonable force against the African-American man. The trio will now remain free on bail pending their sentencing hearing, but the new conviction can affect the severity of their sentence. That has raised hopes for serving justice.
How y'all doing? I'm Philonis Floyd, brother of George Floyd. I have my nephew with me, Brandon Williams, who George raised like a son. Today is a good day for us, that this is the first time that I ever seen something like this. Did four white officers were convicted of killing an African-American man.
The fourth former officer involved in Floyd's killing was Derek Chauvin. Last year, he was convicted of murder and is now serving 22 years in prison. Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck for nearly 10 minutes before he died. The incident happened in May 2020 in the city of Minneapolis. It sparked months of protests, both inside and outside the U.S., against police brutality and raised calls for justice for the black people. The Yemeni army says it has shut down two spy drones over the country's airspace in two provinces. Army spokesman Yahya Sari says the first drone operated by the UAE Air Force was shut down over Jauf province. He says the other one was brought down over Ma'arib province without mentioning which country the aircraft belonged to. Sari added both aircraft were American-made. In the past several months, the Yemeni army has shut down dozens of spy drones operated by Saudi Arabia and the UAE over Yemen's airspace. The army has also carried out attacks against Saudi and UAE targets in retaliation for their ongoing war on Yemen. The U.S. has a hand in the war by providing weapons to Riyadh and Abu Dhabi. At least two people have been killed in fresh clashes in a border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan. The clashes erupted in a dispute over setting up a military checkpost in the area between Chaman in Pakistan and Spinboldak in Afghanistan. The Taliban in Afghanistan say two civilians were killed and 22 wounded. Pakistan also says several people, including four security officials, were wounded. Both sides have blamed each other for making the first move. Kabul and Islamabad have regularly found themselves in border conflicts since 2007. This year alone, they have been involved in three separate fights between their armed forces. Lebanon's interior minister has declared that the security forces of the country uncovered a Daesh-linked terrorist cell which was attempting to conduct simultaneous attacks on Shia religious targets in the Arab country. Mariam Saleh reports.
In what seems to be a hefty catch, the Lebanese internal security forces have thwarted a plan by Daesh terrorists to carry out three suicide bombings targeting religious compounds in Beirut's southern suburbs. Interior Minister Bassam al-Maulawi told reporters that had this terrorist plot not been stopped, it would have taken Lebanon to a very dangerous situation.
A Takfiri terrorist group recruited young Palestinian men in Lebanon to carry out major bombing attacks using explosive belts and using explosives which contain rocket missiles.
Lebanon's internal security forces said the instructions for the bomb plot came from a Daesh operative based in the Palestinian refugee camp of Ain al-Halwi, who is in touch with extremists in Syria. The terrorist operative was given explosive vests and other weapons to prepare for simultaneous attacks on three religious compounds in the southern suburbs of Beirut. This is reminiscent to a wave of attacks in the Beirut suburbs between 2013 and 2014. The instructions were passed to an undercover internal security forces agent who had successfully managed to infiltrate Daesh networks in Lebanon. Observers see that Daesh has lost initiative in Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq and is trying to gain ground.
I think that ISIS is now trying to implement a qualitative operation attack in Lebanon after the death of his leader al-Qurashi in 3 February in Syria, because he lost initiative in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Iraq.
Daesh is seemingly taking advantage of a deep financial crisis in Lebanon to attract recruits, promising them high salaries.
ISIS didn't stop trying to get inside the Lebanese society when he succeeded in to send many young men from Tripoli to Iraq. More than 49 young men have been sent to Iraq. 9 of them have been killed, targeted by the Iraqis just 3 weeks ago. And now the information about a Palestinian cell in the Palestinian camp in Lebanon.
Al-Mawlawi uncovered that the ministry and the security apparatus are monitoring the movement of Lebanese leaving the northern city of Tripoli to join the terrorist group, and have opened talks with Iraqi authorities on this threat. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
And now news of a powerful earthquake hitting Indonesia's largest island of Sumatra. So far, 2 people have been confirmed dead. 20 others are injured. Some buildings, including a government office, have been damaged. The quake was followed by over a dozen aftershocks and caused tremors in neighboring Singapore and Malaysia. Earthquakes frequently shake Indonesia, as the country is placed in a seismically active zone. In 2009, about 1,000 people were killed by a powerful quake there. Truck drivers have continued to snarl highways and to block ports across Italy as their go-slow protest against soaring fuel prices went into its 3rd day. The National Farmers Association has warned such disruptions in delivery operations may result in empty supermarket shelves and food being wasted.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
There are specific criteria for being a revolutionary. In the Holy Quran,
This commitment to values has been referred to as steadfastness. Another example is, as for those who say, our Lord is Allah, then stand straight and steadfast. The angels descend upon them, saying, fear not, nor be grieved, and receive good news of the garden which you were promised. Chapter 41, verse 30. In the Holy Quran, this commitment to the principles and values is referred to as steadfastness. The second criterion is making great efforts to attain our ideals and refusing to abandon these ideas and lofty goals. The opposite of this is laziness, obscurantism, and hopelessness. Some people try to discourage society and our youth by saying, it is of no use, it cannot be done, we will not reach there. And how can we do so with all these oppositions and enmity? This is the opposite of the second criterion.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The second criterion is that we never change our attitude about attaining lofty goals and ideas, and we do not give up in the face of pressure. Of course, when you are taking a path on which there are enmities, they create obstacles for you. But this should not prevent you from moving forward and from continuing the path. We should not give in to pressures, and we should not be satisfied with the status quo. Because if we are satisfied with the status quo, the result will be backwardness. I have repeated many times that the youth should keep moving towards progress and positive change. If we become satisfied with what we already have, for example, imagine that we have made certain achievements in a scientific area which are accepted by the entire world. The whole world agrees that we have made progress in that area. We will remain backward, and we will move further backward. The path to progress is endless. We should keep moving until we reach lofty ideals. As I said, the third criterion is a commitment to independence. Independence is very important. It includes domestic, regional, global, and international independence.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Midstream.
While the current wave of resistance in the occupied West Bank is renewing itself through continuous resistance operations against the Zionist entity and its illegal colonial settlers, the Negev Desert over the past week has joined the series of surprises. after a long period of silence during which the occupation thought that it could simply force the Palestinian residents to evacuate their villages, the recent uprising in the Negev came along to revive the Israeli nightmare of the Saif al-Quds. A threat to the state. The discussion here is not about Israel's paranoia with Iran's nuclear project nor Hezbollah's precise missiles. Rather, what Israel views as direct threat from the people of the Palestinian desert to its actual existence as an apartheid entity. After all, Ben-Gurion, the founder of the Zionist entity, was frank when he said, "If we do not stand firm in the desert, Tel Aviv will fall." This is a quotation that the Karen Kayamet Le'Israel Jewish National Fund used as its slogan decades ago for afforestation of the Negev Desert, addressing its projects entitled Achieving Ben-Gurion's Vision, while of course linking their plans to a number of God's promises exclusively to them. The Zionist occupation referred to the Palestinians of the Negev as the Bedouin problem. Finding a solution for this problem has been since 2005 the responsibility of the Israeli National Security Council, which explicitly means that in the eyes of the occupation, these native Palestinians constitute a demographic and existential danger and an explosive substance that contains violent energy for confrontation. The Knesset even approved in 2005 the Public Lands Law, which stipulates the eviction of public lands from any people, movable property, animals, or every building based on it and everything related to it permanently. For years, this law was used as a pretext to displace Palestinians from the Negev, whether by demolishing their homes, spraying their crops and livestock with toxic chemicals, or bulldozing their crops and planting trees unfamiliar to desert environment as an alternative, as well as imposing outrageous fines on Palestinians who dare enter their own land. The events underway in the Negev are but an episode of the series of devastation that the Palestinians experience there on a daily basis. Under the protection of the Zionist police and escorted by the bulldozers, members of the Jewish National Fund storm what they refer to as the unrecognized villages, raise the lands without any prior warning in preparation for fencing them and then confiscating them for the benefit of the illegal Zionist settlement project. This has been going on for such a long time that the native Palestinians realized they had no choice but to take matters into their own hands and reclaim their rights, because the law in that forest was never on their side. After all, what was taken by force can only be restored by force. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Although there are local reasons for the recent ignition of the Israeli campaign on the Negev, what this region is witnessing today is not far from the historical context established by David Ben-Gurion, since he declared that if Israel does not preserve the desert, then Tel Aviv will fall. A slogan regularly repeated by the Jewish National Fund, which had a remarkable role in establishing the Zionist entity and is working to implement this slogan in Negev with temporary settlement plans. Now, plans that are erected under the pretext of the blooming of the desert project as a cover for the displacement of native Palestinians. On the other hand, these Palestinians insist on clinging to their rights, railing with every possible tool the daily epic struggle and steadfastness. To discuss this issue with us from London is Ms. Sarah Wilkinson, a human rights advocate and supporter of Palestine from a very long time. Thank you very much for being with us, Sarah, to discuss the issue of the Negev. Now, the Israeli establishment with its various arms is masterful in clamping down on the people of the occupied Negev as far as 1948 and attempting to steal their land. But the past week, Zionists were actually surprised with the massive popular upheaval in the areas of Arab al-Atrash and Sa'wa in scenes that brought back to the memory of the Intifada of the Palestinian people of 48. We're talking about the occupied territories inside of Palestine, especially during last May in the Battle of the Sword of Al-Quds. How do you assess such a popular resistance by the 1948 Arabs?
I think recently what we've seen is some very, very coordinated campaigns which have mobilised people not just in Palestine but also internationally. The Save Sheikh Jarrah campaign, Save Silwan, Save Beta, they've all become quite well known, popularised. And so I think that, you know, the resistance against the ethnic cleansing, which is an ethnic cleansing of the Nakab on a massive scale, some of the groundwork had already been laid. And so the Palestinians have become much more like one society, one force against Israeli occupation, which is and less fragmented, which is something that we've probably not seen for quite a long time. So the movement has been growing for many years. But I think the Save Sheikh Jarrah movement, with activists like Mohammed Al-Kurd and Munir Al-Kurd, that has popularized it. And it has made people aware of it all across the world. And it's laid the groundwork for such resistance, I think.
Well, Sarah, it seems that activists in the occupied Negev believe that the aim of this theft is to actually prevent the expansion of the natural expansion, by the way, of the Palestinian villages, and to impose restrictions on their people to force them to migrate again to other areas in occupied Palestine, knowing that the Israeli entity, since after the 1948 Nakba, had adopted the method of afforestation in the abandoned villages to practically just to obliterate Palestinian monuments, Palestinian history from those villages. We see a lot of images and photos of old houses eaten up by Mother Nature because of this attempted afforestation by the Zionist entity. So it's a matter of actual survival for these Palestinians versus an illegal expansion of the Zionist settlement in Negev. In the case Israel decides to ups the ante against the Bedouins, Sarah, will there be coordinated resistance similar to what we saw last May?
Well, this is it. Whether the Palestinians can maintain or sustain this amount of resistance, this is a huge area we're talking about. It's like 3.3 million acres, if I'm right. I don't know what that is in dunams, but it's a massive area. So, and the attempt from the Zionists to take over the Nakab region, that's been going on for decades, probably since 1948. So it's been renewed. With the JNF funding, renewed funding, actually experimental weaponry as well as being used against them. So it's been renewed under the guise of this forestation, urbanization, the new Tel Aviv city, if you like, that's going to be built over the top of these ethnically cleansed Bedouin villages, of which 70 villages, I think, are under threat, or around 70 villages. So this plan has been going on for decades, but what the Israelis have done is renewed it under the pretext of forestation. Well, we're quite aware that, during 1948, over 500 villages were ethnically cleansed. They were wiped off the map, and forestation was one of the ways that they buried these ethnically cleansed villages with non-indigenous trees to make the new settlers more welcome, or, they found the trees more welcoming. Of course, that caused forest fires, which in turn, I think the sinister part of the plot was probably the Israelis don't mind about the forest fires because it finished off the villages and prevents them from returning home. So this plan has been going on for a long time, but it's been revised to look like something that politicians are more likely to want to invest in. It's like a greenwashing. But we must never forget this is a massive ethnic cleansing on a massive scale. And the Israelis aren't just going to turn around because there is some resistance. What it will do is will continue an onslaught, an invasion of the Nakab until it gets what it wants. And yes, the idea is to force 70 or 90,000 Bedouin into small areas near the nuclear reactor, the Dimona reactor, where the ground is toxic.
Because they want to move the people, they want to move the native Palestinians closer to Dimona?
Yeah, I think there's three areas. I think Beersheba is one. I forget one, but the other one is Dimona. But we know that that 55-year-old nuclear reactor has been leaking. The Israelis have been handing out, they've actually been distributing anti-radiation pills to the Israelis who live and work there. So they know the area isn't safe. So you move 70 communities into these 27,000 acres, bearing in mind 3.3 million acres is where they come from, into a tiny 27,000-acre region that is not safe for subsistence farming. What you're doing is not just ethnically cleansing them by making them migrate, you're actually shortening their life expectancy. So actually it's a double ethnic cleansing. I think it's quite sinister to be moving subsistence farmers that work on the land, that have sheep, livestock, cattle, into areas that are not safe to farm in.
Well, that definitely will open up a lot of doors to the actual reason that would push Tel Aviv to do this to the Palestinians, who already know as an occupation. This is something that they have been doing for the past century, but specifically with the Bedouin crisis, moving them closer to such a very high risky area, which kind of seems like they're using them as human shields to protect. Yes. Basically, whatever they are hiding in that area. But it's been a pleasure having you on, Sarah Wilkinson, human rights advocate and supporter of Palestine. I'm sorry that we are out of time, but I promise that we will have you more to talk about this. Sadly, we need to talk more about this as much as we can. Thank you for being with us, and thank you for your time. And please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the Iranian-Syrian new economic ties.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Syrian President Bashar Assad and Iranian Transport and Urban Development Minister Rostam Ghazemi discussed last week bilateral relations, especially at the economic level. Now, President Assad stressed the importance of establishing new projects that achieve the common strategic benefit of Syria and Iran and link the business sectors in both countries. The joint discussions also dealt with ways to expand bilateral work in the public and private sectors and encourage joint investments with the aim of giving a new drive to trade and economic ties. For his part, Minister Ghazemi reiterated his country's firm position in supporting the steadfastness of the Syrian population in the face of the horrific war, the terrorist war that they have been facing, and Iran's keenness to expand cooperation between the two countries in all fields that serve the interests of the two friendly peoples. Iran and Syria to expand trade ties in this following report.
Iranian Minister of Transport and Urban Development Rostam Ghazemi arrived in Syria last week, heading a high-level economic and political delegation to discuss ways to develop economic cooperation between the two countries. Upon his arrival at Damascus Airport, where he was received by Syrian Economy Minister Mohammad Samer al-Khalil and Iranian Ambassador to Syria Mahdi Subhani, Minister Ghazemi stressed the determination of Tehran and Damascus to achieve real economic and trade partnership. For his part, the Syrian Minister of Economy affirmed that his country seeks comprehensive cooperation with Iran, hoping the meeting will lead to good consensus in order to reach full economic and trade partnership between the two countries. Meanwhile, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and Iranian Minister of Transportation Rostam Ghazemi discussed bilateral economic relations. President Assad stressed the importance of establishing new projects that would achieve the common strategic benefit for Syria and Iran and link the business sectors in both countries. Minister Ghazemi reiterated his country's firm position in supporting the steadfastness of the Syrian people in the face of the war against terrorism and American imperialism. Syrian Minister of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates Faisal Maqdad and Iranian Minister Qasemi also met and discussed issues of common interest between the two countries, stressing the need to upgrade economic relations between them to keep pace with the level of development of joint political relations. Iran and Syria had also signed 4 documents to boost cooperation in the fields of trade and industry during a visit of an Iranian delegation headed by the country's industry minister to Damascus last month. The documents were inked at the end of the two countries' joint economic and industrial committee meetings, which were held in the Syrian capital, Damascus. However, last week's important bilateral economic talks came simultaneously as Syria officially joined China's Intercontinental Belt and Road Initiative, defying strict U.S. unilateral punitive measures. Damascus's participation was initiated during a ceremony last Tuesday through the signing of a Memorandum of Understanding by Syrian Planning and International Cooperation Authority Chair Fadil Khalil and Chinese Ambassador to Syria Feng Biao. The initiative gets its name from the ancient Silk Road that once ran through Asia, with West Asia serving as a crossroads to Africa and Europe. The Iranian and Chinese trade pact signed last week with Syria will act as defining goals and guides to all three countries' projects, which will for sure deepen the working cooperation between them and strengthen the harmonization between Iran, Beijing's Belt and Road Initiative and the policies of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, while also strengthening Iranian and Chinese participation in the economic reconstruction of Syria.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Sara Saloum, independent journalist and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Sara. Now, an Iranian delegation headed by Iranian Transport and Urban Development Minister Rostam Ghazemi visited the Syrian capital last week and met with Syrian President Bashar Assad and a number of government ministers and discussed with them the various commercial, industrial, and banking sectors. How do you assess the importance of such economic ties between Iran and Syria at such a difficult time?
Well, let me start by saying that Iran did not only stand by Syria politically and militarily, but also stood by Syria economically over the last decade. This was manifested in two ways. The first is through the delivery of various commodities, oil derivatives, production requirements, and many other essentials to Syria. The second relates to the renewed prospects that were evident in the joint free trade zone between the two countries and the credit line, which was worth nearly $2 billion. Unfortunately, however, the level of economic relations has not yet reached the level of political and military relations between both states. In this context, we saw Minister Qasemi's vital visit to Damascus, where a number of agreements and understandings were signed. What is new in Minister Qasemi's visit to Damascus, other than Qasemi's status as head of the Syrian-Iranian Joint Economic Committee, but also his status as Minister of Transportation and Urban Development in Iran? This is a new indication of the stage that the two countries will enter together to mark the start of the reconstruction phase in Syria after more than a decade of war. Let me pass on to you this piece of information that has not yet been announced. Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi will be visiting Damascus in less than a month. Of course, what will be evaluated in this upcoming visit is the results of Minister Qasemi's visit and also to raise the level of economic relations between the two countries.
That sounds very, very interesting, Ms. Sarah. Well, Minister Qasemi, who heads, just as you said, the Iranian side of the Iranian-Syrian Joint Economic Committee, indicated in a statement after the conclusion of his working visit to Syria that a consensus was reached to work on establishing, quote, a joint bank and opening branches of existing local banks in both countries, in addition to joint free trade zones in both countries. Now, this is a crystal clear challenge to the U.S.'s illegal Caesar's Law that was meant to actually besiege Syria financially. How do you think the Americans will react to such a new financial deal between Syria and Iran?
Let me just make 2 points clear. The idea of the Syrian-Iranian joint bank is not a new idea, but it was established in 2009 or 2010. That is actually obtained a license to operate in Syria under the name of Bank of Hope, but kickstarting that bank was not successful at the time for various reasons, but what matters today is that it has been revived. This idea is to reactivate this bank again. You asked me about the American reaction to these economic ties. Certainly the United States will not be satisfied or pleased with these relations. But regardless of this, Iran has always succeeded in evading illegal American sanctions. Iran succeeded in delivering all derivatives to Syria and broke the equation of unilateral punitive measures by delivering aid to Venezuela and to Lebanon as well. We even witnessed the war that almost erupted in the Arabian Sea after the United States of America tried to block one of the ships transporting Iranian oil derivatives. And you know very well that today there are negotiations underway in Vienna. If the results of these talks are positive, it is a good thing. And if not, I think that there are escalatory steps that Iran will take to break the siege, and the financial and banking sector is not immune to these steps. I'm referring here specifically to the Syrian-Iranian joint bank, which will be activated soon.
Well, Ms. Sarah, Minister Kazemi said something very interesting during his visit concerning transportation in various sectors being one of the most important requirements for both countries' economic development. So the road the U.S. waged war against Syria to prevent from opening between regional countries, especially Iran, Iraq, and Syria, will officially be opened soon. Some might say Syria paid a heavy price for this road. Do you agree?
Of course, Syria paid a heavy price for this road and this war in general. Syria, as you may know, was a strong country in West Asia. It has moved from being a country that is self-sufficient and food-sufficient with zero foreign debts to a country that, unfortunately, is experiencing suffocating economic and social crises. But for now, what is most important is that the blood of the martyrs should not be wasted, the blood of the martyrs who fell in this war. An important issue you touch upon is construction and infrastructure project that will link the three countries, Iran, Iraq, and Syria, together. This project will bring about very important economic and political results for all three states and will provide jobs for many citizens. This project will not only transport goods between the three countries, but will also transport citizens. For instance, goods used to take 2 months to reach from Iran to Syria. Today, thanks to this project, if it is successfully implemented, goods will only take a few days to reach Syria. The project's starting point will be the Iranian-Iraqi border. It will stretch to reach Al-Qa'im, then to Al-Bukamal, and then to Homs, and to end off at two destinations, the Syrian capital Damascus and Latakia on the Syrian coast. Certainly, this project will have very important economic and political results. Also, this project will be linked to other networks in Central Asia, and in turn, these networks will be linked to other networks in Russia and China.
Well, Ms. Sarah, exactly what you said is very important because officially Syria has joined China's Intercontinental Belt and Road Initiative, defying strict U.S. sanctions, which I don't like to call sanctions. They are unilateral punitive measures by the United States of America against Syria in hopes of securing a lifeline for lucrative investment in a country that is still ravaged by more than a decade of global war against it. Now, Damascus participation happened during the same week which it's actually signed the new deals with Iran. It did the signatory with the Chinese ambassador in Syria, Mr. Feng Biao, opening up to Iran and to China in the same week. Look, I can hear Americans screaming because of this, but how do you think this step will benefit Syria in the upcoming future?
Of course, the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, or the One Belt, One Road Initiative, is the largest initiative of the century. And since the planning of this initiative, Syria was destined to be an essential component of it, but the war effectively delayed its accession to this initiative. You also remember that the Chinese foreign minister was in Damascus in the seventh month of the last year, and he signed that at that time this agreement to return this year to the signing of a memorandum of understanding between the Syrian Planning and International Cooperation Authority and the Chinese side, authorizing Syria's entry into this initiative, which includes several economic and social aspects like health, education, and most important of all is the aspect of reconstruction. We may not see its results tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, but we will certainly see them soon. You know, the direction of the Syrian government today is to head east. Unfortunately, we have previously experienced failed projects with the European Union, which used our economy to blackmail us in politics and impose unjust unilateral sanctions. This is a fundamental reason for what we Syrians are experiencing today from several stifling living and economic crises. Meanwhile, China has proved in the past 10 years that it is an economic superpower that has been rising tremendously and has also proven that it is a trustworthy partner. I stress here on the word partner because it has established a new concept in international relations, which is partnership between great powers and other countries instead of the concept of hegemony.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Ms. Sarah Saloum, independent journalist and political commentator, for joining us from Damascus to talk about the recent economic ties between Iran, Syria, and China, for that matter. Thank you very much for your time, and thank you. And please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream. Bye-bye.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light. And there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my dear guest speakers in the program, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid Abdullah, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Welcome. Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam, glad to be here.
Welcome. Well, we promised last time in the previous episode that we are going to continue talking about the movie The Da Vinci Code and criticizing it content-wise, not artistically, of course. And we reached a point where there is a talk of the Holy Grail for the first time. Let's take a listen to that part, and then we'll be back.
The Pope sent troops to claim the Priory's treasure, but they found nothing. The few surviving knights of the Priory had vanished, and the search for their sacred artifact began again.
What artifact? I've never heard about any of this.
Yes, you have. Almost everyone on Earth has. You just know it as the Holy Grail.
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. And we are trying to criticize the movie The Da Vinci Code, produced in 2006, played with Tom Hanks, the major and famous actor. Well, Sayyid Abdullah, you know, there is this concept of the Holy Grail and in Christianity, which is a very sacred concept, of course, or notion. And I guess the whole movie is like revolving around it to some extent.
Yeah.
Right? What is the story behind it? And is this a story real at all?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When you talk about the Holy Grail, it's a mix of mythology and Christianity together. Now, the Holy Grail itself, whether some of they say it's a cup or a stone or a dish or a container, it first serviced in, I think, 2nd century, if I remember correctly, around that time. It was in a novel, a romantic novel. So at first, it wasn't a romantic story that depicts that one of the disciples of Jesus, when Jesus appeared, that he collected and gathered the blood of Jesus in that container.
Yes.
And thus they believe that this container, whether it's a cup or a dish, what have you, it holds superpowers. And then he sent that cup to Britain, to Great Britain back in the day where the people are. And from there it became like a belief, a doctrine in Christianity. But it started as a science fiction. Oh, I wouldn't say science fiction, but at least it's a myth, it's a story that actually became something now. Like when it's, oh, the Holy Grail, everyone knows the Holy Grail. But no one knows it doesn't even exist. It's just a, you know, a figment of someone's imagination, a romantic story.
I see.
So it has no basis to it whatsoever. But Christianity kind of, they became...
So it's not like the staff of Prophet Moses.
No. It doesn't even exist. There's no such thing as a Holy Grail.
Right.
Like I said, it serviced in a movie, and then they for some reason, they gave it a life, they gave it existence, and they pushed it to the outside. The same thing with the Trinity, mind you. The Trinity never existed in the Bible. It came to the Bible.
Of course, it came after Christianity.
Way
like,
after. And they put it in the Bible. Now, if you ask any Christian, Trinity is part of the belief.
Yes,
one is three and three is one. Mathematically, is not possible.
Yeah.
But apparently, Christian-wise, it's possible.
Yes.
So a lot of these things managed to get their way into the Bible, into the Christian belief, and became reality. So there's no such thing as a Holy Grail.
Okay.
But the movie, though, they have a nice twist, though.
Mm-hmm. I see.
The Holy Grail.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, Brother Zaid Abdullah. Let's take a short break and listen to a part of the movie, The Da Vinci Code, and then we'll be back with his critique.
Vatican Cellars, 1976.
76, a year of independence, how fitting.
I thought you'd like it.
Back to the program. Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. We are still criticizing the movie The Da Vinci Code, produced in 2006. And we just listened to a part of the movie The Da Vinci Code. And this part, Brother Hussein, there is a priest offering a bottle of wine to another. Why is there this culture of drinking in the first place in Christianity? You know, despite lots of disadvantages for it.